Global Media News Time, live from Studio A. This is Global Media News on OWWR, Old Westbury, Web Radio. I'm Miguel Castro.
And I'm Ben Lemon. You're listening to Global Media News from the New Media Newsroom on OWWR, Old Westbury, Web Radio.
This week in Global Media News, we have media news from Japan, South Korea, the United Kingdom, Russia, and India.
From Japan,
why is anime so popular and influential around the world?
From Korea,
esports news.
Just how big is, how popular is League of Legends?
From the UK, can British regulator Ofcom convince the world to crack down on social media?
From Russia,
is Vladimir Putin winning his war on memes, and can memes even be defeated?
From India,
our introduction to social media in India.
And can the Indian government convince the giants of social media to control social media content before the 2019 elections?
All this and more coming up on OWWR, Old Westbury Web Radio, streaming live from the State University of New York, College of Old Westbury.
Let's talk about anime with Brendan Litford. Brendan, what do you think has made anime so popular with audiences around the world? And just how influential are these Japanese cartoons?
Well, that's a good question, Ben. I think the reason why anime is so popular is because it's becoming much more acceptable. As from way back then, like in the 90s, it was mostly directed for a handful of audiences and like people that were shut in, that didn't really have, like, what do you say, like girlfriends or actual friends at all. It has now become much more of a popular medium in like many ways. Like you see like everyone walking like with t-shirts of anime characters, or you see people wearing like Naruto headbands and watching shows. It's becoming even more of an adult sort of demographic now. Like moving away from like kids, like you and I, we grew up on like Pokemon. So it's moving away from that and now focusing on like adult content.
Totally. Why is anime becoming so popular now?
I think it's because of the stories that they tell. It's more compelling. As for like American stories, they're not as compelling as anime stories. Like the characters are much more emotional. They're far more serious. There's something relatable, like you and I could relate to.
And that's what makes the anime story so compelling.
Yeah, that's what makes it so compelling. Those emotions that the characters sort of go through, like they go through struggles and hardships, like we go through every single day, and so we can sort of relate to them on those kind of levels.
What countries did anime influence to get them to create their own kind of anime-inspired cartoons?
The countries that were influenced by anime, I would say the U.S. For example, we have Avatar: The Last Airbender, The Legend of Korra.
For sure.
In 2007. We have the Thundercats remake that came out a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And so that had anime influences, and I think why it was so influential is because of like the actions that the characters go through, the emotions, the world building that these characters sort of made the world feel very realistic. And that's why that was influential to the United States. But another country that made anime influence shows were France. Like, I don't think you probably heard of this one, like Code Lyoko.
Of course.
Oh, okay. And like Totally Spies, in which Those were shows created in France. Mm. When I was researching this, I was like, seeing, like, oh, I didn't know they were created in France. I thought they were created in Japan, since they were like very anime-oriented. Like, it took place in high school, took place with young kids, and the world is very fast, and wild, and monsters, and bad guys. I see that with like, anime, Japanese kind of medium, not much of a France kind of medium.
So what are you watching lately?
Well, the shows that I'm really watching is, first, My Hero Academia, which is one of my favorite shows. I love the character. They go through a lot of emotional strife and a lot of triumphs. My favorite character will happen to be Bakugo. He's very strong-headed, pretty violent, but I like his character. It's a lot of emotions with him.
What about Hero Academia do you really like?
I like the world. It's a very, it's sort of Western in a way. The reason why I like it is because it's sort of taking a superhero genre and mixing it up a bit. Instead of like everyone having, I guess, a superpower, like before they have a superpower, they have a quirk when they're born. So that's the superpower. And it's either up to them if they want to go on the side of good or evil. That's what I'm
like. All right.
And from Mobile Media News, this is Brendan McCord. Back to you, Ben.
Thanks, Brendan. Now let's hear from my co-host Miguel Castro with the media news from South Korea. He's been keeping an eye on the sports industry. This week, he's here to tell us about the popularity of League of Legends in Korea. Miguel, just how popular are esports in South Korea, and what about League of Legends? Is League of Legends the most popular esport in South Korea?
Thank you, Ben. Not only is League of Legends the most popular esport and game in South Korea, but it's actually the most popular video game in the world. There's been some crazy amounts, up to 100,000 players just in North America alone, and the extent of how popular the game is actually has gotten to the point where 1% of the population actually plays the game or has played the game. This all entails just absolute. It's all based, for those listeners who don't know what League of Legends is, it's basically this MOBA, and for those who don't know what MOBA is, it's a multiplayer online battle arena. It's based around 5 against 5 characters on each on-step team, and they continue battle or objectives until one of them finishes the other's base, or Nexus as it's called. It might sound simple, but there's a lot to it. But other than that, there's a huge audience for this game, specifically in Korea, but it's gotten to the extent that this is the biggest professional esports scene. So next week actually is the League of Legends World Championships, which is bringing in big numbers, especially because the last 2 years, the finals, if you watch more than the NBA finals, it's been competing now big time with like big other esports. It's gotten to the extent where ESPN, who once had something against esports and said, that'll never be a sport, they are taking their words and eating them now, because they are now featuring League of Legends, Heroes of the Storm, and other video games on their own channels. That's very interesting. And to the extent where this right now, before the League of Legends World Championships, the biggest sponsorship has been made in the past week, which has been MasterCard, who's now sponsoring League of Legends.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So we had our Toyotas, we had a lot of big companies, but for MasterCard, which is an international sponsorship, it's going to allow not just this World Championship to possibly be the biggest scene, but it'll allow other set leagues to actually be financed properly. So, for example, right now, there's NA and EU-LCS, which is the league competitive series. Those are the two biggest ones, as well as the Korean and China leagues, the LCK and the LPL. But there's a lot of fans in the South America regions, like especially in Brazil. There's a huge passion for it, but there's just not enough investment, especially when you have players in North America and Europe that are making a career out of this, making 60K plus, free living, free food, free travel, free gear, all these things that are like making them steady. They have insurance, they have retirement funds, like they have amazing, like livable, like enjoyable wages and enjoyable like living standards. And compared to some of the South American or Oceanic teams that are actually just, they're in it because they like it. They're in it because they might have a chance to face one of the teams in the World Championships. They don't necessarily make a living wage off it. They don't necessarily, like, they get to make their names known and they get to be the best in their region, but there's just not enough growth coming out of those that. But recently, with this whole MasterCard investment, they're actually making, if you use your credit card as MasterCard, you get extra points in the game, so, like, you can buy more skins. They're actually having set sweepstakes, so hey, you like the game, if you use your credit card to buy things in the game, you can have a chance to meet the players. But rather than Korea for the All-Star game, there's a lot of really big expense, and this is really great to see, especially that now these teams are going to get investment, especially because, I don't know about if you guys have learned about the esports scene, but we literally just sold out Brooklyn, we sold out the arena in Brooklyn, what was it? Barclays, yeah, we just sold out Barclays Center in like around 2 weeks for Overwatch League. To the extent of esports, just around the world is insane because right now you literally have before the game some Schalke players. That Schalke has their own team, which is a professional soccer team. They're being introduced with the soccer team themselves. Like, I don't know about you guys, but at the beginning of the last NBA season, I don't know if you guys were there, but. Well, maybe you guys are watching, but they introduced, with Golden State, they introduced the Golden Guardians, which are their team, which they finance. I went to a Mets games a couple Mets games, not really for the Mets, I'm a Red Sox fan actually, but they had NYXL, which is the New York Excelsior Overwatch team that actually, it just, they were introducing, they sold out the game because the fans of the Overwatch team wanted to, like, meet the players and watch them throw instead of actually just the team. So the extent of MasterCard investing in a lot of leagues and showing that it's the biggest sponsor of League of Legends, it's very, very compelling, especially because right now we have a couple of professional teams invested in the esports scene. Like, there's many rivalry within League of Legends where if you're a Cavaliers fan, there's a team. It's the MDS, actually. And then you have, if you're a Golden Guardian, a Golden State fan, you can go for the Golden Guardians. And there's Schalke FC and the European region. There's a lot of teams that are getting in on this. And right now, there's actually 7 teams interested in a European spot, including Manchester United, including Manchester City, these big-time names. It's very interesting, and there's millions and millions of dollars going into it. Rick Fox, former NBA player and quite an entrepreneur and mogul, is invested in Echo Fox, which is one of the bigger teams, and he's putting money into it. It's crazy. But overall, these tiny teams like are making a difference, not just on stage and showing upsets at the World Championships, but now that they have financial means to compete and grow, it'll just make the game not just better on the competitive level and have more of an even playing field, but it'll actually allow these leagues to have growth, and people won't have to quit the sport for financial reasons.
What are your thoughts on making esports a career, and how there are like 19-year-olds that are already retired and they are basically set for life? Do you think that's setting a good example?
I think that for you to decide to be a professional player, you have to already be one of the best. So, for example, I've never told anyone this, but I was thinking about doing it for League of Legends myself. In my first year of college, I was playing the game 9 hours a day and then going to college and still working. And that wasn't really healthy for me. I ended up in the hospital because of that. But I was a really good player, and I really thought that I could make it if I kept on that track. And no matter what happens, like, even now, photography is my life. I go hard on whatever I'm passionate about. I endorse everything. So I realized that if something's kind of healthy, it's probably something you should take back time on, so quit for a year. And I've just been playing casually since. If you want to be an esports player, the first thing you have to realize is you can't just be better than average, which is something I realized I was. I was a top 15% of players. That's not good enough. To be a professional player, like,
you have to be top, like, 5%.
Less.
That's stretching.
Like, to any of our listeners, I'm not trying to be good, but if you want to be a professional esports player, you have to be the top 0.05% of players. The rest aren't good enough. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter how much time you put in if you're not part of that 0.05%. And yes, there's millions and millions of players, tens of millions in this region alone. If you're not part of that 0.05%, you're not going to be good enough. So you shouldn't drop everything unless you know that you're either close and are willing to put in the effort.
So, do you still play?
I play now casually with friends. I don't like to go on my 9-hour spews. I ended up getting, that was a lot. I initially had to transfer because it was too much. But it's a good game. You know, it's the most famous game in the world, so you get to play with people all over the world. Like,
last question, who do you main?
I'm a support main for the, I help us, I feel, respect them. I gotta keep everyone safe, just like in real life. So, my main right now is Zillion and Pyke. So, for those who don't know, Zillion is more of like, he slows down people, he brings them back to life. I know it sounds really nerdy, so those of you guys don't know. And then there's Pyke, who's a bit of an assassin support, which is strange. But, he basically does damage and saves people. But, yeah, from Golden Blue News, I'm Miguel Castro. And back to you, Benjamin.
Thanks, Miguel. Let's jump from Asia over to Europe for reports from Great Britain and Russia. Should government regulate online content? Ofcom thinks so. Do other countries agree? Stay tuned.
Oh, that's very web brief.
Welcome back to Global Media News. I'm Miguel Castro. Logan Mitchell is here with media news from the United Kingdom. Ofcom, the British government regulatory authority for communications, is advocating a global effort to regulate and control social media content around the world. Logan, what is Ofcom? Is it like the Federal Communications Commission here in the U.S.? And what is it regulating in Great Britain?
Hi, Miguel. So, as Americans, we're able to speak freely on various public social platforms, like Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, even blog posts. But many countries are taking action to protect the public from hateful or offensive content, somewhat limiting the freedom of speech and expression. Ofcom is the British regulator for communication services. It works by regulating transfers or exchanges of information, such as Royal Mail, television, radio, even airwaves made by wireless devices like walkie-talkies. Led by Sharon White, the company plans on collecting regulators across the globe to collaborate and plan this action to protect the public from online harms on social media platforms, many of which are actually based in the U.S. According to an article in The Telegraph, Ofcom leads global assault against social media abuses to protect the public. Ofcom believes that social platforms such as Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube are dangerously underregulated. Because of this lack in regulation, studies have shown a high level of child exploitation, which is considered to be by Ofcom and many of the members of the public as a priority threat. Teenagers, preteens, children are all subject to the potential dangers of the internet. And currently, there are no simple solutions for parents to restrict the unknown. Standards seem to have slipped in terms of what can be posted on such public and easily accessible platforms. Ofcom believes lessons can also be learned from countries that have introduced new laws, including Germany, where social media platforms are set to remove hate speech, and Australia, where the government can block and filter internet content. According to The Telegraph, the threat of adult predators pretending to be children in an attempt to groom young girls and boys, kids seeing mature content and exploitation are the top concerns, over 50% actually, of internet users. Other areas that are less of a concern but still worth noting for internet users are accidentally witnessing self-harm, violence, bullying, or harassment, and on a smaller scale, fake news. People seem to consider these legal yet unwanted content a threat to their use of safely using public social platforms. Stated within the article aforementioned, Andy Burrows, the NSPCC's associate head of child safety online, said, "When there is such widespread public agreement about the problem, and in the face of years of failed self-regulation by the industry, the government needs to deliver a solution. With protection and security in mind, Ms. White of Ofcom hopes to tighten regulations through the threat of fines in the face of any breaches to the new plan of action. She hopes to allow people the right to speak their minds while also limiting the amount of time that harmful or offensive posts can remain visible to the public." In an article on BBC News in 2017, the topic of online streaming, live streaming, and its threat to the younger population in the United Kingdom and elsewhere is discussed in urgency. The article states, "Social media channels such as YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Snapchat all allow some form of live capability, while there are also many pure live streaming services, including Periscope, Omegle, LiveMe, and Lively. Through these platforms, according to police officials, predators thrive. Despite the incredible capabilities of the internet and the technological advances that have had positive impacts on human life, we need to work harder to protect our children from the serious threats they face daily from the unknown. The internet is a dark place that can lead you in the wrong directions, but with the help of Ofcom and, you know, other government officials, we can hopefully make these threats limited."
All right, so Logan, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Do you think anything good can come of websites like Omegle?
Definitely. I mean, if you think about it, it's all about communication and globalization, meeting people from other countries, meeting people that could potentially live down the street from you. I mean, it's a cool idea to make friends and, you know, waste hours of your precious time. But at the same time, it's things like Omegle that, you know, predators thrive. Predators thrive through these live streaming websites, and there's no way to really regulate them because there's no one person or no way to control what these children or teenagers are seeing in that moment. You cannot block this harsh content, you know, while it's happening.
So well said. Danger. Very well said. Fun fact, I actually met my girlfriend 4 years on Omegle.
No way.
Yes, we're still together. So.
That's easy. See, well, there you go. Good thing you were not a predator. Yeah, that would have been bad.
Sure, I mean, I'd have to ask you, what's your personal, like, I don't know if you use Omegle or any of these other streaming sets, what's your opinion on them? Do you use them? Do you think that they should be there just like, in case you want to have fun or something like that?
So I've never actually used them myself. I had friends in high school who used to use, you know, Omegle and websites like that just for fun, just to mess around and waste time, just because, you know, that's what teenagers do. They look for things to have fun and joke about. So I understand that that is, you know, something that these kids want to do. But at the same time, I believe that there should definitely be an age requirement. And I think that they should really rein in on how they determine how old the users are. There should be some type of official action to make sure that people using this website are not high school students or children or preteens. It should just be really, really much more regulated for safety purposes.
And how do you think they would enforce that?
I mean, there are ways, you know, a lot of websites always say, like, how old are you? And then you click 18 and it's okay. Then you go on. But with something like this and how serious it can be, the threat levels, I think it needs to be something where you either have to scan an ID or you have to put in more information so they can be, you know, sure that you are 18 or older. That's a good question, actually. I've never really thought of that, but I'm sure there are ways. For Global Media News, I'm Logan Mitchell. Back to you, Miguel.
Thanks, Logan. My co-host Benjamin Lund has a report about media, Russian media for us. Vladimir Putin has been waging a war against internet memes and has been mercilessly mocked Yeah, just kind of crazy to see that there's a war on memes. Benjamin, can you give us some examples of these anti-Putin memes and what Putin's government has been doing to combat the meme menace in Russia? Can you even stop the meme once it's gone viral? And what is Putin really going to do about this?
That's a couple of good questions. I'll start with a couple statistics. Last year, according to SOVO, which is a non-governmental organization that tracks radicalism and human rights violations in Russia, 658 people were convicted for various forms of, quote, extremist speech, such as, quote, again, insulting the feelings of religious believers, incitement of hatred, and calls to terrorism and separatism. And another 3,511 were fined for similar administrative violations. That's up from 133 and 182, respectively, in 2011, the year before Putin began his third presidential term. This also happens to be the term in which he instated multiple policies against any kind of political opposition. Remember that? When Putin straight up threatened people with arrest and jail if they ran against him? Anyway, about 90% of the cases, compared with about 10% in 2007, involve speech on the internet. An overwhelming majority of these, in turn, involve posts on social networks. Many of these posts were memes making fun of our boy Vlad, one of which depicts him with some killer eyeliner, mascara, and lipstick with the words Stop Homophobia on his forehead. This image, later titled Gay Clown Putin, was actually banned in Russia, and if a Russian citizen posts it anywhere, they get fined worse. Last year, Viktor Nochinov of Sochi was convicted of insulting religious feelings and fined 50,000 rubles, which is $712, so not as much as you'd think it was, but still a lot, for posting images lampooning Jesus Christ. In one of them, the cross is replaced with a pull-up bar. In another, excuse me, blue ad, Jesus is glued rather than nailed to the cross. The man got arrested for it. Also in 2017, Mikhail Penkin, a left-wing activist, was jailed for 4 days in the town of Dzinski for publishing anti-Nazi pictures that contained forbidden Nazi symbols.
Good what?
Yeah, for example, one of a fist squeezing a swastika carrying Nazi eagle. Last week, actually, Magomed Diyov from Nalchik reported to SOVA, he had received a suspended sentence for publishing memes, which included a crown wearing Putin and a picture of Stalin with the legend, "The more you kill Russians, the more they like you." It's not all bad news, though. Lately, Putin has been softening up to the memes. Bloomberg.com says that the ridiculous convictions make Russia look like a two-bit dictatorship scared of its own shadow. So it's easy to see why the Putin establishment is willing to take a step back from its crackdown on supposedly extremist speech. Most of the cases deal with far-right utterances and memes, often anti-Semitic or anti-immigrant ones, which would probably qualify as illegal hate speech in a number of European countries, too. But a noticeable number are so absurd they open the Kremlin to ridicule and unwelcome comparisons with the Soviet regime in its late senile phase.
Why do you think the Kremlin is attempting to rein in viral images of Putin?
I think it's part of a wider attempt to control sexual abuse and online free speech, things like that.
But that, you mentioned a gay Putin image. What's the deal with that?
That image became popular in 2013 after Russia passed a law banning propagandizing to children about, quote, non-traditional sexual relations. And gay rights protesters were beaten and arrested, so it's more of a protest image than a meme, I suppose.
Just as a question, this whole banning memes thing, is it? I don't know about you, but as someone who looks at a lot of memes, there's been a big spur in memes specifically about that. Do you think that this whole banning thing might not really be the way forward with stopping these memes, and it might actually just be making more?
There's actually names for that phenomenon that I've forgotten, because why wouldn't I forget? But yeah, very, very awesome. Like, let's say a celebrity leaks, or somebody leaks pictures of a celebrity that they don't want out there. When they try to attempt to get those pictures off the internet, a lot of the time, it makes the memes and the pictures spread more. You know, it's better to let sleeping dogs lie in that case, I figure.
Okay, gotcha. So it's kind of like a case of bad, like minor attention is better than no, don't look at that, because everyone's going to be kind of compelled to.
Yeah, I remember a couple of years ago, actually, this exact phenomenon happened to Barbara Streisand's house. Yeah, some guy with a drone was on, I think, the California coast, and he was just taking pictures of the coast, and one of the pictures happened to be Barbara Streisand's house on the side of a cliff, and obviously, nobody wanted that picture up there, anybody associated with Barbara Streisand, so it's like, oh, that's where she lives. And so they tried really, really hard and made a public announcement, like, hey, delete this. it got super popular for about a couple months, a couple years back, and it was a big thing for a while.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but most of the time, if someone says not to do something, and it's kind of clearly just because it doesn't have any effect,
I'm going to do it.
I'm going to want to do it, unless it's like life or death, totally. What kind of laws have been officially passed in Russia regarding free speech on the internet, by the way?
Russia passed its first internet extremism laws in 2013, according to the Moscow Times, a year after Putin returned to the presidency and began restricting civil rights. The paper did report a year later that Putin signed the law imposing prison sentences for people who give so much as an upvote to a forbidden online post. It means you can get in jail for being on Reddit. Those include an article about a theoretical coup which landed a philosophy professor in detention. Anyway, from Global Media News, I'm Benjamin Lohman. Back to you, Miguel.
Thanks, Benjamin. Up next, India. Let's get an introduction to social media usage in India. How many Indians are using the internet? Which social media platforms are most popular?
India is a big country that's growing fast. Its economy, its population, and the number of people using the internet and social media are all growing. What do we know about social media use and the internet in India? Global Media News reporter Emily Sorella is here to give us some of the basics about social media use in India. Emily, talk to us about internet penetration and the basic statistics of social media use in India. What percentage of the Indian population has access to the internet and social media?
So 28% of India's population uses social media. This may seem like a small percentage of the population, but it shows that India has the second largest number of internet users in the world. The number of users have increased in the last 4 years, and 462 million of India's 1.3 billion people are online nowadays. And their favorite and most popular sites are all seen to be American social media websites. This has made it more accessible for Indian users to gain access to more social media outlets for their own personal use, business, and pleasure. India has over 260 million active social media users, Facebook being the first company used. For the last couple of years, Facebook has remained the largest used social media site worldwide.
and Facebook has about 241 million video users out of the 260 million social media users.
So why has the numbers increased in the last 4 years?
India has made it more capable to reach the internet. There has been a rise of mobile data plans, and it becomes more affordable and ubiquitous for people to actually reach.
Awesome. I actually did a piece on the boy phone and how it was doing with the 4G, actually. It was really interesting. What do you think of American social media is so popular in India, and why would they use their own media?
I think it became more impressive after learning about how some of the locations in India have patchy infrastructures and fixed telecom lines, and it's hard for people to gain access, so I don't think they make their own social media. I think it's easier for them to find spots that have either data outputs, or they have internet in places like public restaurants, hotels, and it's easier for them to reach our network than to make their own. A lot of people have to walk miles to gain access to the internet servers, and it was crazy to find such high numbers and how the rates for internet usage is still so high because they have to go so far to use it.
So what other forms of media are popular?
Ranker.com had the source of information calculating rank of popularity, the first one being Facebook, as I said, second being Google, third being Twitter, and YouTube being fourth, and LinkedIn being fifth. Indian civilians say that they use these social medias for their businesses, creating awareness, building a community, engaging with customers, and to remain updated with other countries. India has a lot of cafes and restaurants, which make it easier to offer free Wi-Fi at low speeds, but this tends to obstruct smooth internet connection. And for some applications, don't work without a certain amount of data capacity. Most cities do not have Wi-Fi zones, but they've made it more accessible for people who are even traveling to rent portable devices that are $250 a day to use their internet servers. And for Global Media News, I'm Emily Sorella, passing it back to Ben.
Thanks, Emily. Let's keep talking about social media in India. Brandon Johnson has been learning about social media in Indian politics. There are important elections coming up in 2019, and many Indians are concerned about the role of social media in Indian politics. Many Indians are getting their news and information from social media, and not all of it is accurate or objective. Brandon, tell us a bit about the problem and what Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government proposes to do about the power of social media in Indian politics, and especially in the upcoming elections.
Yeah, man, thanks, Ben. So this is a very controversial topic. We all know that, you know, when it comes to elections and stuff like that, you want the right campaign and right from your candidates. You want to see news, whether it might be good or bad. But the problem in India right now is that they're going to be using the analytical tool. All right, I know that sounds crazy, but they're using this tool to, like, basically monitor people's, you know, messages, how they put on their social media platforms, whether it may be positive or negative. And you know what? There's been a severe case of invasion of privacy, and we all know India is a democracy, but that seems not to be the case. You know, if they're doing something like that. So, you know, India, they want to ensure people by, you know, having this deal with Google, with Twitter, with Facebook, that they're not getting fake news, quote unquote. You know, we heard that many of times from our president, but it's the truth. We don't want to see fake news, and they don't want that at all, and they don't want false advertising. You know what I mean? So they don't want those pop-ups that, you know, kind of display the candidate or bring them down in a sense, because, you know, ultimately they don't want people to just go based off of social media. Of course, there's other ways you can advertise candidates on TV, billboards, flyers, you know, public speaking events, stuff like that. So I think this is a great, you know, a way for India to really come out and be like one of the first countries to actually do this. We all know what happened with the Cambridge Analytica, you know, stunt with Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook owner, you know, basically taking private information from United States citizens and business people around the world and, you know, putting it out there, you know, because he's being too greedy, you know what I mean? He's already a billionaire, and I guess the motive was to actually continue to, you know, grow Facebook and expand it. But when it comes to personal information, I think that's the problem, right? So India did spend over $140 million, the central government, let me say that, in advertising. Advertising is a big thing nowadays. The whole world spends over $1 billion in advertising, right? So we're in the state of technology where it's big, and, you know, we like to promote a lot. So Facebook, Google, and Twitter, those are one of those sites that you can see that a lot. But in recent years, of course, there's been a lot of, you know, negative posts and stuff like that. So India wants to cut that down, because right now, as he mentioned in the script about democracy, for Prime Minister Narendra Modi, his government. They don't want to be looked at as a negative government. I mean, you know what I mean? Because people want to be able to choose the candidate that best fits them, you know? So this is still a democracy. And, you know, India is just one of those innovative countries that are always trying to benefit their country in a sense, you know, try to be one of the top dogs in Europe and, you know, all of the world. So, you know, fake news and, like I said, false advertising is not one of those things they want to commit to. But you know what? They're in the right direction.
So why is monitoring an election through social media so important?
I think it's important because you don't want people out here saying negative things that can potentially, you never know, hack into someone's system and break down everyone's votes and the polls might get messed up because, you know, you might have one candidate that's very highly favored to win and then someone else might win and then it's just like, whoa, why is that possible? And then when you go back to the analytics, you know, the statistics, and someone has hacked the system, it's not going to be fair to them, you know, sure. So I just feel like that's very important to have, but then again, there's also other factors to that.
Do you think that opens up other opportunities for other countries to do the same?
You know, that's very interesting that you say that. Mm-hmm. Maybe countries like China, maybe other small countries, I think it might be a good tool to, you know, partner up with these social media giants because they do run the world right now when it comes to anything you want to promote.
So why is India one of the most successful countries?
Well, India, I spoke about this last week on my topic of Mukesh Ambani. He's one of the richest, excuse me, billionaire in Asia. When it comes to India, that country itself, they have people that really take the risk. They have people that are very smart, innovative. They own multiple companies, natural resources. As Miguel and Emily mentioned, they have their own 4G network, and it's affordable for their people. I think that's what's really, you know, making them one of the top giants in the world.
Do you think it's right for India to have analytical tools? What are the pros and cons of that?
That I don't agree with. Just like if it was to happen here, it wouldn't be fair to us, right? Because the Constitution states we have the freedom of speech, excuse me, Bill of Rights, of course, first of all. It's not good because you don't give people the opportunity to express themselves. You know what I mean? That's not fair to us as a voter to be controlled by the government. I mean, that was never the case, you know? So it's just, that's the con about it. But the pro is, like I mentioned in my earlier statement, that you can have the ability to now know what people are thinking about or how, you know, people on social media help actually, you know, promote a lot of things and actually make the world go around. So I think that's the pro about it. But do I agree with it? No, because invasion of privacy, like I mentioned, we all are entitled to speak our minds, say what we have to say. But when it comes to, like, I guess, maybe bomb threats or anything detrimental to a candidate or anyone in society, that's when you step in, but overall, I wouldn't agree with it. But for Global City News, I'm Brandon Jones.
Thanks, Brandon. And thanks to Benjamin Lumman for listening this week.
You're very welcome.
Thanks to our great engineer, Brandon Johnson. And many thanks to Kristen Gray for producing our show today.
Today, we heard reports from Miguel Castro, Emily Sorella, Brandon Johnson, Brandon Lindler, me, and Logan Mitchell.
Global Media News has been brought to you by OWWR, Old Westbury Web Radio, and the Media Communications Department here at SUNY University of New York College at Old Westbury.
For more media news and resources, check out our latest posts on the Catalyst at globalmedianews.org, where you can listen to all of our webcasts and even subscribe to our podcast feed.
Follow us on Twitter at OWWRGMN. Use our Twitter feed to keep up with the latest news for aspiring journalists and media professionals. That's at OWWRGMN.
Stay tuned for more great programming coming up next on OWWR Old Westbury Web Radio.